Welcome to Tentpole Trauma, the podcast where we look at movies that came with hype and high hopes, but left with crushing disappointment, either critically, at the box office, or both. Freed from the weight of expectations, we seek to examine these underperformers under a new light, parsing through the good, the bad, and everything in between with the hopes of gaining a better understanding as to why they failed to find their audience. Warning, there will be spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie that we're discussing today, I suggest you stop the podcast and go watch it. Then when you come back and listen, you'll get more out of the discussion. On this episode, we discuss The Legend of Billie Jean. I'm Sebastian, and I'm here with Jennifer.
Hello.
And it's a Just the Two of Us again.
Just the Two of Us.
We had to throw together an emergency podcast because one of our hosts was feeling a little under the weather.
It was a real emergency.
It was an emergency, but you know what? Fair is fair.
That's right. Fair is fair.
Because we are doing The Legend of Billie Jean, a teen drama from 1985.
Yeah, sure.
I think this fits in nicely with a sort of genre that was going on from the late 70s to the early 80s, which is sort of like teen rebellion, mm-hmm. right? This one sort of takes it to a different level with this sort of creation of a folk hero with the character of Billie Jean. Now, I would say that this movie probably wouldn't have been considered a tentpole necessarily, but I do remember this movie coming out in 1985, and it got a lot of promotion through MTV, mm-hmm. Specifically because of the Pat Benatar song Invincible, mm-hmm. which is featured heavily in the movie and will no doubt be played in this episode.
That's going to be the song you choose?
I mean, come on, right? It's got to be Invincible. It's a good song.
It's a badass song.
Gets me kind of pumped.
It gets me pumped too. I'm like, I want to just belt it out right now.
I hope that people listening have listened to Invincible and they're feeling really pumped.
One to get you pumped.
Because I'm pumped.
I'm pumped.
I'm pumped to talk about The Legend of Billie Jean.
We will be invincible.
So yeah, as I was saying, I don't think anybody would have thought of this as a tent pole. I don't know how much money it cost to make, but it probably wasn't that much. But it did make very, very little at the box office.
I don't know how much it cost to make, but I would say, I mean, they shot all of this on location. It takes place in Corpus Christi, and they shot all of that there. And there's several locations where they're throughout there. And then they are in Vermont at some point as well, and they're really in Vermont. So they did go to these spots. They didn't recreate it.
Yeah, it probably wasn't like super low budget or anything like that. For what it is, I think it was probably kind of expensive. The director of this film is Matthew Robbins, and I'm not really familiar with his work. However, he's mostly known as a screenwriter, and he comes from the like American New Wave movement, which included George Lucas and Walter Murch and Steven Spielberg. And he worked with all those guys on films like The Sugarland Express and Close Encounters of the Third Kind and Jaws. And he even worked with like Guillermo del Toro on like Mimic and Crimson Peak, and recently on Pinocchio, the one that Guillermo del Toro just did. So he's been around for a long time. He's been in the industry for a long time, and he's been working with some heavy hitters. So
he also wrote Dragon Slayer.
Oh my goodness. Did he direct Dragon Slayer?
I don't know.
So yeah, we've talked about him before when we reviewed Dragon Slayer.
Yep.
I felt like his name sounded familiar, but Matthew Robbins is kind of a common sounding name.
He's back here again on Tentpole Trauma, as is Helen Slater.
That's right. So yeah, welcome back, Matthew Robbins, and welcome back, Helen Slater. Now, Helen Slater is the star of this film. Before this, she did Supergirl the year before. This was during the big push to make her a big name, I guess, because two leading roles in 2 years is a pretty big deal. We also get Christian Slater in one of his earliest roles in this film. They're not related.
Nope.
Just a happy coincidence. And they are playing brother and sister, which is kind of cool. And they look like brother and sister.
Yeah, totally.
So that casting works. I mean, Christian Slater's hair is dyed blonde, but I think her hair is also dyed blonde.
Yeah, I mean, but I'm used to seeing her blonde. I mean, she was blonde. Well, she's brunette as Lisa Lee.
Right.
And Supergirl, right? Isn't
yes.
she? Yeah, she's brunette, but when she's Supergirl, she's blonde, so.
I don't know what her natural hair color is.
But she pulls
it
off.
Yes. It does look bottle blonde in this movie.
I mean, it's really blonde.
So I'm assuming that both of them had dyed their hair for this part.
Well, Christian Slater definitely did. He said he did.
Yes.
Like, but yeah, she's got like Daenerys Targaryen hair going on. Before we get further into that, I did want to also bring up, did you know the writer for this?
No.
Mark Rosenthal. I was looking at some of the other projects he's worked on, and he wrote Jewel of the Nile.
The subpar Romancing the Stone sequel.
Yes. And it says he had a screenplay for the 2001 Planet of the Apes.
Oh my goodness. That's the Mark Wahlberg one, the Tim Burton.
Yeah. So anyway, he was one of the writers for this. Oh, screenplay for Sometimes They Come Back.
So he's really had an illustrious career as a screenwriter.
There's been some things going on here. Screenplay for Superman 4.
Also terrible. This is just a litany of disaster.
Yep. And Lawrence Connor is the other person who's credited with writing, who looks like Star Trek 4 he did the story for. Also credited for the screenplay of Planet of the Apes, the 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And Superman 4 also.
Well, good for these guys.
Yeah, whatever. It's all good.
You take the work where you can get it.
That's right.
I remember this film coming out, as I said, because there was a heavy push for this on MTV. I feel like most of the marketing they did was on MTV, which makes sense. You're trying to appeal to teenagers in 1985, and that was the hottest ticket in town,
That's right. Let me
tell you.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I was very well aware of it just because that Invincible song would play every hour, and there were a lot of clips of the movie in the video. And I just never got around to seeing it. I don't think I saw it until it showed up on cable. And when it was on cable, I probably would only catch a few minutes at a time. So honestly, I didn't even see this from beginning to end until, I don't know, a few years ago. I mean, maybe even when you bought the Blu-ray. So I'm pretty new to The Legend of Billie Jean.
Well, I'm not. I watched The Legend of Billie Jean very often on cable. I did not see it in the theater. I also do remember the Pat Benatar video because I loved MTV and watched it every chance I got.
You would have been too young to see this in the theater at the time.
but I was certainly watching MTV. Yeah, when it came out on cable, I've seen it numerous times over the years. That's why we needed to get the Blu-ray.
So you would say that you're a fan of this film.
I'm definitely a fan of this film.
I mean, you kind of love this teenage rebellion genre.
I really do love it.
Your favorite film, or at least one of your favorite films, is Over the Edge, the 1979 teen rebellion film.
Yes, that's also a film that I saw on cable quite often at a very young age that shaped my view on things.
Yeah, great film.
It's a wonderful film. It's so well done.
So yeah, I mean, this is a fun genre that, yeah, we both enjoy. Mm-hmm. And I definitely think it was in the air at the time, from the late 70s to the mid to late 80s. I mean, even stuff like Foxes and...
Another favorite of mine.
I mean, Lost Boys. I mean, it's vampires, yep, but it's still teen rebellion.
That's right.
It's just tons of movies about teenage rebellion that made up that era. I mean, even in some ways... E.T., at a certain point, the kids are rebelling against authority to save E.T. In the 80s, it was kind of understood that kids knew better than adults.
Yeah, you know? Even Goonies.
Right.
It's a lot of kids like coming together to fight the man.
Yeah.
And usually the man's being pretty bad.
Yes.
This story has a little more redemption in like the lieutenant they're dealing with, who I think is the coolest cop of all time.
Well, it's Peter Coyote, who was also in E.T. as the government guy there. A little less sympathetic there, but I believe he has sympathetic moments in E.T. So it makes sense that they cast him in this role because it's a similar role to what he played in E.T.
I don't really remember in E.T. You know how I feel about that film.
It's not one we watch
It's not one we watch often because it made me cry big time when I saw it when I was a kid. And I was like, I don't need to go through this again. I know it's a great film. I know a lot of people have love for it, but I just don't like those feelings.
It's a good film, but I feel like it's one that sort of lost its luster over time. I don't know a lot of people who talk about how often they watched E.T., whereas Poltergeist, you'll still find people who love that film and watch it all the time.
And like us, we just watched the 4K, which is amazing. Thank you, Troy.
And Close Encounters.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's other Spielberg films that, even though they weren't as much of a phenomenon as E.T. was at the time, they have aged better. Now, let's start with the basic setup. It takes place in Corpus Christi, Texas,
right.
On the water.
It is so hot there.
It really does look hot in the
movie. It looks miserable. I mean, I think it seemed like they're shooting there in the summertime and everyone is sweaty. It's hot.
Yeah, I'm not really aware of this part of our country. I've never been there. I do like it as a setting. I think it's a cool, unique setting. And our setup is that we are introduced to the Davies, Billie Jean Davy, and what's Christian Slater's
Binks,
name?
Binx. I thought it was a nickname, but then at one point we're shown like both Billie Jean and her brother in their high school yearbook, and it's Binks, B-I-N-X, that's his name.
So Billie Jean and Binks live in a trailer park, so let's say they're lower income. And Binks has just recently gotten himself a sweet Honda Elite scooter. Now, I remember when these scooters hit, these were a big deal at the time. It looks like a bumper to a like sports car over the handlebars. Mm-hmm. It's really strange. I think it's a design that still exists now, but it was a big deal in the 80s. These were like the hot thing in 85. So I appreciate that they've made that kind of like the inciting incident is that Binks's scooter gets fucked with.
Well, and I appreciate also about this inciting incident is we don't waste much time at all. We get right into this. Right from Jump Street, they're getting menaced by Hubie Pyatt.
Yeah.
They're at their home. And we see Christian Slater rolling out the fancy red scooter. And we see Helen Slater taking her shirt off, getting dressed in her, like, I get it because it's hot, but she's really, I don't want to sound like I'm slut shaming because that's not what I mean at all, but she's like wearing like not much.
The camera's not being shy about sort of ogling Helen Slater's body.
Not
at
all.
It's sort of ironic where the movie's going to go.
Yes.
Because, you know, in this whole opening sequence, they go out to get ice cream and Hubie and his crew give them a hard time.
Hubie and his crew are like waiting for them or something because they pull out of their home and they're on the road going to the drive-in or whatever to get get their milkshake is what they're going, because it's freaking hot out. Everybody's sweating, no AC. And they're already like menacing them in the car on the way there and like taking pictures of her on the bike. And there's this one guy in the group with a camera who's like just snapping pictures all the time. They're just complete assholes. And they get there and then they like, Hubie comes over and takes his gum out and sticks it on Binx's bike.
Yeah, it's over the top sort of bullying.
So much, so fast.
But I mean, I think, and Peter Coyote points this out, we're to sort of assume that this is because they've all got the hots for Billie Jean.
Yes.
Really bad. And they don't like Binx because he's a little wise ass punk, but they're all hot for his sister.
They are horny for Billie Jean. And she's, I mean, Helen Slater is gorgeous.
Yes.
And she's got a beautiful figure, and she's not paying these dudes any mind at all. She's just hanging out with her brother.
I did come to this podcast prepared to dig into Helen Slater's acting a little bit.
You wanted to be a Slater hater.
I wanted to be a Slater hater because I do think she is legitimately bad in Supergirl, and I stick to that opinion. However, watching it this time, I think she does fine in this movie.
I think she's great as Billie Jean.
I wouldn't go as far as to say great.
I don't know. Who else would you want to play Billie Jean?
I don't know. It could have been anybody. I mean, there are better actresses in the world than Helen Slater.
She's understated.
She's good in this movie.
Yes.
She does the job. She pulls it off.
Look, I think she's fine. I said she's fine in Supergirl. I wasn't like, she's great in Supergirl. She's fine. You're the Slater hater.
She's bad in Supergirl. Yeah. She's not bad here.
I think she's great here.
Well, I'm definitely not a Christian Slater hater. I am a Christian Slater fan.
Yes.
And I had not seen him until, I think, Gleaming the Cube. Yeah. So I didn't even remember him from this movie. And when you got the Blu-ray, I was like, oh, wow, Christian Slater is kind of like the second biggest character in this movie. And he's great. You can see where he's going to go in terms of his talent and his charisma. Heather's was when it really kind of hit home to me that he was actually a really good actor.
Yeah.
He's great in this movie. I really enjoy him in this role. He's perfect as like the, I wouldn't say he's bratty. He's got a chip on his shoulder.
He's angsty.
Yeah. Chip on his shoulder big time.
Yeah.
I mean, he's getting bullied left and right. So who can blame him?
Yeah.
But, you know, he's willing to throw the milkshake in Hubie's face.
No, that was his sister.
Oh, right. She throws the milkshake in Hubie's face. Yeah,
because he was being a creep.
So they end up going to this swimming hole or whatever. And, you know, Christian Slater's warning her about alligators and stuff. I know that might have been triggering for you as somebody who grew up in Florida.
Somebody who does not go in these type of bodies of water ever.
But I mean, this is where we're really getting some prime Slater ogling, because she's in like skimpy bikini bottoms and like a half shirt t-shirt or whatever. And it's even kind of used in the movie because the bullies are going to show up and take the scooter and do donuts with it and stuff. But the creep that you pointed out with the camera is taking pictures of her as she's getting out of the water, and that picture is later going to come back as something that gets plastered up all over the place. So the movie's definitely trying to have its cake and eat it too by saying, oh, here's this hot chick, and isn't it terrible that she's getting so objectified? But the movie's willing to objectify her too. It's the 80s. That's how things were. I think today, if this had been made, there probably would be less of a male gaze placed on the Billie Jean character.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong.
So yeah, I mean, I do like this setup. And like you said, like, we're off to the races really quickly.
Boom.
The scooter gets stolen.
Yep.
They go to the police, talk to Peter Coyote, but he's kind of just brushing them off. He just thinks they're kids. He's like, get in touch with me in a few days if the scooter doesn't come back.
But we know he's cool already because there's two other friends that live in the trailer park, and it's Martha Gammon, who plays Ophelia, and Yeardley Smith, the voice of Lisa Simpson.
That's right.
Who plays Putter. Ophelia has wheels, so she takes Billie Jean, and Putter just wants to tag along to go to the police station. And this is where we learn that, like I said, that Peter Coyote is a cool cop because Putter blurts out while they're there. She's like, Hubie isn't going to return that scooter. And she's like, why, you know, well, why wouldn't he return the scooter? And she goes, because he's a fucker. And then, you know, they say, oh, that's, you know, that's just how she talks. And then he gives Billie Jean his card and says, if that scooter's not back on your lawn within a couple of days. And she's like, we live at Breeze Haven. He was like, if the scooter's not back in front of your trailer in a couple of days, give me a call and we'll go get the fucker.
Right.
So we know that he's a reasonable man, even though he's kind of blowing them off.
This is cluing us into that he's going to be a sympathetic character, mm-hmm. even though he's on the other side of the conflict, ostensibly. I think Yeardley Smith is really good in this movie.
Me too.
I think she's got an interesting look. I think she fits in really well in this group mm-hmm. as a sort of kind of comedic character. We're going to see her like eat a lot of junk food. And I do have to say that the girl that plays Ophelia is the weak link in terms of acting.
I think she's fine. She doesn't have a big part. She's driving them around. Like it's not that deep. I think she's pretty.
It's not that deep and she's not that good.
I think she's fine. I believe that these four kids would hang out together. Like, that's what I believe. And Yeardley Smith, I was reading the trivia, she was already 20 at the time.
Yeah.
And she's, like, having to play, like, this 14 or 15-year-old girl.
I mean, at one point, she even gets her period yes. for the first time.
Yeah.
Yeardley Smith is probably the richest of all of these actors. She's been on The Simpsons for, like, over 30 yep. years. I'm sure she is insanely wealthy, probably even more so than Christian Slater, who, you know, is probably the biggest name coming out of this. But, yeah, she's probably the one with the most money in the bank.
Yep. And there's times throughout the film where when she delivers every once in a while, like a certain line, I'm like, I could just hear Lisa Simpson, you know, which is great. Such an iconic voice.
Yeah. Her voice is so distinctive. It's, you know, it's impossible to watch this movie and not think that Lisa Simpson mm-hmm. is on the screen in some small capacity, but she is doing a South Texas mm-hmm. accent and stuff. And she does it well.
She's totally pulling it off.
She's a good actor.
I think so too.
There's a reason why she's been in a character in a cartoon for 30 years
yeah.
because she's really good.
She is good.
The scooter does get returned, although it gets returned in like mostly destroyed shape. And Christian Slater is beat up really bad.
Really bad. And I get it because we wouldn't have a movie otherwise. But I'm like, this would be a moment to call Peter Coyote.
Yeah.
Because like he's like so beaten up. Like he's bleeding profusely and his bike is completely destroyed. And it's like we can handle this right now. Yeah. But I know, but then we have no movie.
Well, I also think what the movie is trying to tell you is that nobody cares about these kids.
Yeah.
If they were middle class kids or upper class kids, then the police would give a crap.
Right.
They probably wouldn't even be getting bullied to the extent that they're being bullied because those kids know they can bully them and get right. away with it. They know they can trash the scooter and get away with it because who's going to care about the kids who live in the trailer park?
Yeah. No, it's true.
It's a little over the top. And I mean, especially the way they're just being bullied immediately.
Yeah.
Like there's no setup. We don't ever see where they go to school. I mean, I think it's supposed to be
summertime.
Right. So they're not in school, but we don't really get a sense of like where they fit in the community other than the fact that these other kids that are just on them constantly.
So that's what I was saying. Things are shitty.
We see their mom. Their mom yeah. is dating kind of scummy dudes because she's a divorced mom.
Well, but Billie Jean looks out the window and she's like, well, he looks nice. I mean, he like smiled and waved at her. I mean, I think, you know, she's having a tough time.
Yeah, he looks like an oily car salesman right. or something.
But he's there throughout the rest of the film, wherever the mom is. So
yeah, maybe it worked out.
Maybe it worked out. Billie Jean decides that they're going to take this into their own hands. They're going to handle it themselves. So off screen, she has gone and gotten an estimate for what it's going to cost to repair the bike.
$608.
That's right. And that's for parts, labor, and tax.
Mm-hmm.
And so Ophelia drives her and Binks to Mr. Pyatt's store. This is Hubie Pyatt's father, his like store, which is like a, I don't know, tchotchke type beach shop where you get like, you know, shells and flip-flops and kind of touristy stuff.
So they go to kind of try to shake him down for the money. And Hubie is there. He makes Hubie go get a sandwich while he and Billie Jean talk this through or whatever. And of course, the dad is a total scumbag, sleazebag.
He's the best sleazebag ever. He's so gross.
He's played by Richard Bradford. I'm not aware of this actor. I don't recall him from any other things. He looks familiar, but I can't easily recall him from anything else. But man, does he play a good scumbag.
It's because he looks a little like Jackie Gleason.
He does, yes.
It's like, he's got like the pencil thin mustache. I mean, he's way sleazier than Jackie Gleason.
Yeah.
He's Jackie Sleazin.
Yeah. But
he's so gross. He makes her go upstairs to get the money because he doesn't keep that kind of money in the cash register. And she even looks at him like, and he's like, what, don't you want the money? And so she like begrudgingly goes up this like little spiral staircase with him. And immediately it's terrible. He's like, here, gives her $50. And it's going to be pay as you go, earn as you learn.
Yeah.
It's so gross. I mean, he's like literally throwing out all these like sayings to her that, you know, she's going to come back and he'll give her a little more each time for a little slap and tickle.
Well, in the meantime, Binks comes back into the store looking for her and he opens the register and finds a gun in the register. And the dad and Billie Jean come downstairs. He's still groping her even at this point. And it ends up escalating and Binks ends up shooting the dad in the shoulder. He's not going to die, but this is what kind of kicks things off into high gear.
And Mr. Pyatt says to Binks, he's like, that gun's not even loaded. I'm not going to keep a loaded gun in the cash register. And Christian Slater just kind of turns the gun. He's like, it's not loaded. And so he's like not even pointing at him at all. He's just kind of looking at him and pulls the trigger by accident or whatever. And that's how he's shot. So it's not even like menacing in any way. He's not even aiming at him.
Yeah. And this is something that I kind of want to talk about in a larger sense in this movie. We're going to get a lot of escalation here. This is going to escalate things so that now they're on the run, you know, which is where we're expecting them to go. But everything that happens, the consequences are never that dire. And as a result, this whole movie ends up kind of feeling low stakes because the dad doesn't die, right? So Binks isn't guilty of murder. No. I mean, it's still a big deal that he shot the guy. But then, like, once the police get involved, they kind of think this is all sort of ridiculous. They think that the dad should just pay her and end all of this, even though he's been shot. You know, I think in real life, it really wouldn't matter at that point. It's like, well, the kid shot the guy. He's going to go to jail. There's going to be charges pressed,
right?
Even if it wasn't his fault, even if he didn't mean to shoot the gun. Like, at this point, it should be a big deal no matter what. But the movie kind of keeps pulling back on the stakes of everything. And I feel like if this movie had been made now, there's no way it would remain this low stakes throughout the whole movie. It would be like, no, the father dies. And, you know, even at the end, something's going to happen that you think is high stakes and it ends up not being high stakes yet again.
No.
It's weird. It's almost like it was a conscious decision to just not push things too far. And I wonder if that was some sort of almost socially conscious decision, because at this time in the 80s, yeah, there were a lot of movies about like teenage rebellion, but they never wanted to depict it as something that bad. You know what I mean? It's not like Over the Edge where things really escalate to a crazy degree. It's like things don't quite get as bad as they could. And I feel like that's a conscious decision.
Yeah.
Because, you know, at this point, Billie Jean and the Yardley Smith character, well, the whole crew is going to kind of go on the run and they go and stay in an abandoned
mini golf
course and stuff. And, you know, we're just basically getting this like teens on the run kind of story at this point.
I also wanted to bring up something that I was noticing this time. This is the most knee-nutting film that I can ever recall seeing. Billie Jean knees at least three men in the nuts in this film.
Yeah.
You just don't see that often anymore.
Yeah. Maybe we need more knee-nutting in movies.
Maybe we do. But they go on the run. They've still got Ophelia's wheels. It's her dad's car. You know, at first Ophelia's going to just drop them off. Putter's just going because she wasn't even at the incident where this happened, but Putter just doesn't want to live at home because her mother's terrible and like grounds her and smacks her around. They're on the run. They're getting blamed for all kinds of bullshit that they're not even doing. People are saying that they're getting robbed by the Billie Jean gang.
Mm-hmm.
It's even ridiculous where the cops are like, this is all bullshit, because it's like people are claiming things are happening like simultaneously. They couldn't be like in Galveston and, you know, Dallas or whatever. They don't really go that far too. That's another thing where it's like they don't have a lot of money and they don't want to steal anything so much that like when they go to try to have another meetup to turn themselves in and get, you know, get the money for the bike, they go through this mall and they're putting IOUs for everything that they're taking from like the toy store. They take like some walkie talkies and
G.I. Joe walkie talkies. Yes,
of course, G.I. Joe. It was the time of G.I. Joe, and batteries. And Binks steals like a little cap gun. Yeardley Smith and Binks are like ready just to be outlaws. And Billie Jean is really like, no, that's not what we're doing. You know, fair is fair. Like, we just want the money for the bike. And, you know, we're not going to steal anything. We're not going to steal gas. That's her moral compass.
Binks with a toy gun is a little uncomfortable after so many years of kids being shot for having toy guns. Yep. Binks is going to get shot at the end of the movie with the toy gun.
Yep.
So that's a little uncomfortable.
It's very uncomfortable.
And yeah, and he's kind of waving the gun around really liberally in that scene in the mall, which is a fun scene because, you know, Billie Jean's supposed to meet the sleazy dad, even though the cops are all there watching, Peter Coyote's there watching, but there's going to be like a drop where she's going to get the money. But of course, once she gets down the escalator, he like drops the envelope on the ground and like
steps on it.
He
goes, Hubie! And Hubie like comes out of like the escalator that's like getting shrouded in like plants or something.
Yes.
And like leaps out at her. It's like, it's so funny. He's like, coming out. It's pretty great. And so again, she's like fighting. I think she knees Hubie in the nuts again there.
Yeah. And she like runs up the escalator, like crosses over to the other side where it's going up and all this stuff.
And we should also mention that we get sleazy Mr. Pyatt talking to Peter Coyote, and he's like, how much money do you make per year? You know, like, Mr. Pyatt will not give her the money still. So this is Peter Coyote's money that's in the envelope.
Right.
Because he just wants this thing to end. This poor lieutenant who's like not making anything is like, here, take the $608, because this asshole is like, I get it, he got shot, but he's an asshole. Like, just freaking pay her.
One way that I felt they was telegraphing that Christian Slater was going to die, which, spoiler, he doesn't, although they make it seem like he does, was because he keeps bringing up wanting to go to Vermont. Because Billie Jean has told him about Vermont. He even has a poster in his room of this sexy, like, snow bunny.
It's like something about the slopes or something on this. It's like some sexy saying about slopes.
Hey, look, this was common in the 80s. This is true to form. I remember a lot of my friends having really dumb pinup posters like that, where it was just advertising some resort or something with a girl in a bikini. It's just how it was back then. So he's dreaming of Vermont, and I'm thinking, oh man, this is telegraphing right here that this character is going to die. Whenever a character is thinking about a better life in a movie like this, you know they're tagged for death.
Yep.
And I'm willing to bet that in some version of the movie,
he dies.
He did die. Because that ending scene that we get, spoiler,
is just like tacked on.
Yes, we get a scene at the very end where they're both in Vermont, and it seems like they shot it in literally like 3 hours outside a ski shop.
It's so much that you and I both, and I've seen this movie so many times, and I do remember that they end up in Vermont. But I thought there was more to it than like literally this 2 seconds. And they are really in Vermont.
And he comes out of the shop and he sees a snowmobile that looks kind of like his scooter. And he goes, oh, wow. And then it freeze frames
that's
there.
It. Yeah. And I'm like, that's it. The end.
It looks like they literally just ran out of time. And they're like, how are we going to end this with the footage we have? I don't know. Just freeze it when he looks at the snowmobile.
It's the most forgettable ending of a film that I've seen in a long time. Like, I knew they got to Vermont finally, but it's so just tacked on.
All right, so back to the main meat of the movie. The next thing that happens that's significant is they are looking for a place to hide out, and they go to the rich part of town, and they see this house that looks like nobody's home, and they break in, and we see some shots of somebody's in the house watching them on CCTV mm-hmm. cameras, which would have been a big deal in the 80s. And then Billie Jean wanders upstairs because she hears a noise. And we see this like figure in like a wolfman mask or something kind of like following her. And I had completely forgotten about this. I'm like, what is going on? Like, I've forgotten the wolfman character. And he startles her, pulls off the mask, and it's Keith Gordon, an actor who I absolutely love. Love him from Christine, love him from Dressed to Kill, love him from Back to School.
Yep. And an amazing director, too.
Yes.
He's directed a lot of really great TV.
Yeah, and this was kind of a thing in the 80s, too, like the kid who likes horror masks and stuff like this. I mean, we saw it in Friday the 13th. Mm-hmm. We see it in Salem's Lot. This is kind of a recurring character, although they don't go too much into that aspect of him. I think it's more implied that he's just into filmmaking.
Yes.
Because he's got a Betamax camera.
That's right, Betamax.
Which would have been pretty sweet in 1985. He's got a sweet-ass pool with, like, a slide going from his window.
Which we both had that slide envy of that. I was like, wow, man, I wish I had that going out of my window right into a pool. She also hits him in the nuts, too, with a guitar.
Oh, right, yes. A hollow body Gibson, I
believe.
That's right.
But he recovers from it, and he's totally cool about everything. He's like fine with them. He's like, yeah, I just live here with my dad. He's out of town on business, and there's, you know, a couple of people that, you know, help us out here, but they're not here. So
his dad's a politician played by Dean Stockwell, mm-hmm. we'll learn later.
Yeah, he's running for like attorney general or something like that. Yeah, he's just like ready to hang out. He's like, he knows who she is because now, you know, she's in the papers and on the news and whatnot. And this is around the time where people are saying they've done all sorts of shit that they haven't done. So she's really pissed about it. And this is also where they're flipping around the TV and they'd seen the news that are saying this and that about them. And it's a bunch of lies and she's getting real pissed. And she flips to Joan of Arc. And Yardley Smith is like, is that a girl or a boy? And he's like, it's a girl. It's Joan of Arc. And, you know, he explains a little bit about Joan of Arc. And Billie Jean asks him, you know, does she win? He was like, yes and no, you know, because they win the war, but then her people burn her alive. So Billie Jean's just watching this movie and getting some inspo. Everyone's hanging out in the pool and she's like, you've got a video camera, right? You can, he's like, yeah. And she was like, can you make copies of tapes? He's like, as many as you want. And he knows what she's planning to do because she wants to tell their side of the story.
So she goes upstairs and she cuts her hair really well.
Yeah, very well.
She has a very stylish short 80s haircut and she cuts like a
wetsuit.
And has these cool 80s pants on, and she looks really kind of cool and badass. She's got some dangly earrings, and she gets in front of the camera, and she kind of like explains her whole situation and says, you know, fair is fair and all that kind of stuff, doing the kind of manifesto-y type mm-hmm. tape. Now, here's a couple of thoughts I have about this.
Okay.
First of all, like, great look.
Give a moment for when she's like standing, comes walking up and everybody's just like, holy shit. And the pool, like the lighting and everything reflecting off of her, and it like pans up and you just see her. And it's like, this is the iconic, this is like the cover of, you know, posters, the cover of the Blu-ray. This is like, this is it.
I really like it. I think it's a really cool, iconic look. Here are my thoughts. One, I kind of wish she wore this outfit for more of the movie because she doesn't really wear this outfit other than this brief scene for the camera. And B, like, they're making this big deal about her short haircut, and it's cool and it's striking, but this was a common haircut like in the 1985. Later, all these girls are going to get their hair cut just like Billie Jean, you know? And it's like, Sheena Easton had this hairdo. Like, lots of people had this hairdo. This is not some, like, it would have been way more radical if she had, like, shaved her head in, like, 1985. Like, if she looked like Sinead O'Connor before Sinead O'Connor, this isn't really that rebellious. It's a stylish 80s look. Yeah,
but it is in the sense because she is, like, a very beautiful girl, and everybody keeps saying
and
that
she's still beautiful with the short hair.
No, she's even hotter now.
Yes,
but People have wrapped up things. Like, she had like gorgeous long blonde hair, and it's saying something to like hack that off yourself.
Yes, but it's not the Joan of Arc like.
No, it's definitely no. That's not Joan of Arc's hair.
No,
that's not Joan of Arc's haircut at all. Joan of Arc had like shaved her head.
My point is that they were afraid to go too far with her look.
Well, they still wanted to make her cute.
Right. It's not selling to me that this is some wild, rebellious look. This is just, hey, you got a cool haircut. You know, like, you got a haircut that you would get at a salon in 1985 or now.
Yeah, but she looks tougher now. She looks like she's not messing around. Like, I feel like when she had her longer hair, which she would have like little braids or whatever, and she just looked, even though she was, you know, still tough and holding her ground, like, I don't know, I just feel like when she does this, she's like taken more seriously. Even though I hear what you're saying, it's a stylish haircut that was popular at this time.
It's the way the movie is trying to sell it, like, that if she had just like cut her hair and that was part of the story and they weren't making a big deal out of it, then it wouldn't matter. But the way they do it, they're like, oh my goodness, she cut her hair, and now all these women are right. Gonna rise up and do the same thing,
right? Like, not everybody else was already having that new wave haircut.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, this would have been a common look for many women at this time.
But maybe not in Corpus Christi.
Maybe not.
You know, it's more Southern, and maybe not. Maybe it was kind of a big deal.
Stop defending the
movie. I'm going to defend The Legend of Billie Jean. Somebody has to. I was reading in the trivia that Pat Benatar says before every time she plays this at one of her shows, this is the song from the worst movie ever made.
Oh,
I know.
Well, speaking of people with short haircuts, Pat Benatar was rocking that look
forever.
For like 5 years before this movie came out.
No, and then like I always think of when I see Pat Benatar too, I think of that scene in Fast Times when they're in the cafeteria.
Yeah.
Phoebe Cates is like talking about different people in the cafeteria. And she's like, oh, there's three girls here that have cultivated the Pat Benatar look. Yeah. And there's like, they all look exactly like her.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that hair has been rocking for a long time.
It's just the way the movie presents it, as if it was some bold, rebellious move.
Just like Joan of Arc.
What would have been bold was for her to shave her head bald like Sinead O'Connor. In 1985, that would have been radical.
Yeah.
I'm sure that was the original conception and they just didn't have the balls to do it because... Oh. You know, it would be too much. Kids wouldn't be into it. She wouldn't be as cute or whatever.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's kind of what you feel like the movie's trying to do anyway, because she almost got molested. And isn't she kind of trying to make herself look less attractive in a way?
In a way. I mean, I think she's trying to de-beautify herself in some way. But I'm telling you, it's like, no, I'm like, she looks better than ever.
Well, and she's wearing makeup
right.
and stuff.
No, so it's, I don't know. It's some sort of empowerment. You don't know, man.
Yes. I don't have any right
stay
to
in
speak
your lane.
About this.
Stay in your lane. She's empowered.
She is empowered.
She
That's
is.
True.
She is.
I'm just saying the hair isn't the selling point.
You don't get to say.
It's a good haircut, though.
It's a really cute haircut.
She did a really good job on her hair. Wow. It's almost as if a stylist did it.
You don't think it was her going upstairs into the bathroom and cutting her hair?
No. So, you know, they're all going to move on from Keith Gordon's house.
Lloyd is his name in
Lloyd.
The film.
But Lloyd wants to come along, but they're like, you know, you can't come along. But he sells himself as their hostage, mm-hmm. which is a fun idea. And he's like, hey, if you take me as your hostage, you know, my dad will make a big deal about it. Sadly, his dad only offers $10,000 for his son's return.
Which the kids all are like, we're rich.
Yeah.
I know. And he's like, great. I mean, his dad's like super loaded. He's like, yeah, here's 10 grand.
This part of the movie is where I feel it kind of gets a little lost in the weeds. At one point, they split up because they go to like a golf course or something to get a car.
It meanders before then. When the group is all still together, a couple of them go into like Woolworths or something to get her a wig.
Mm-hmm.
And she and Putter are in the car. And these little kids come up and they're like, are you Billie Jean? And Putter's like, you bet she is. And they're like, you got to come help Kenny. He's in trouble. So this is where we're seeing that she definitely has this cult status now amongst the youth. So she's walking and all these kids are like, oh my God, it's Billie Jean. And it's like this whole gang of kids walking up to like The worst drunk, abusive dad, like, of all time. He's so gross. And this poor kid, like, she opens the door.
The kid's just cowering.
Cowering over by the couch, all bruised and beat up. And she's like, come on, we're going to go. And he was like, the dad's like, who are you? And she's like, I'm Billie Jean. He's like, no, you're not. And there's just beers everywhere. And he's got, like, a belt. And he's ready to go hit Kenny again. And he's so sweaty. And it's just, it's just so gross. And just like a lot. And then the dad looks outside and there's like, now Christian Slater showed up and Keith Gordon, and there's this like massive kids all around the house. And he's like, you really are her. Would you like something to drink? I got some sodas out back in the fridge. Like, he's all nice about it now. And so then she goes outside and she's like, Kenny's gonna go live with his grandma for a while. And they're all, yay. Yeah. So it's like, I get it. It's a good thing that she's doing, but it's kind of like we're meandering a little bit from being on the run. And I guess it's just trying to show us how she's become iconic so quickly.
Yes. It's trying to show us how she's become this figure of rebellion, a folk hero, but it's kind of just a lazy scene.
Yeah.
I get what's trying to be communicated. Sure. I think it could be done better.
No, this is, I told you, this is where I kind of always would kind of lose interest a little bit here. Because I'm like, I mean, it's a good thing that's happening, but it's just the way it's executed is just like, okay. So after school special.
Yeah. And it's also around here where they get split up because they try to steal a car at a golf course. And she gets into a little fight with Keith Gordon, who there's been sort of a romantic interest in him.
But she's already, but you also, she's called the cops. She doesn't want Ophelia and Putter to be around anymore because it's getting too dangerous, because they get chased by Caroline Williams.
Yes.
And this dude, and she's, Caroline Williams's character is just like, oh my God, it's Billie Jean. And her boyfriend like pulls out his shotgun.
No, not a shotgun. Rifle. It's a high powered rifle.
A rifle, and is like shooting at the car because he wants to get the reward for Keith Gordon.
Yes.
And so she's like freaking out in the car, like, stop shooting. And they blow out the back window and the front window. And he finally shoots out a tire. And their truck like just flips over because they're like kind of on an incline.
It's a good car stunt.
It is a good car stunt. You know, they go somewhere to try to fix a tire. And she tells Keith Gordon, she's like, I can't have Ophelia and Putter involved anymore. Like, this is too dangerous. So the lieutenant comes and they split. And the lieutenant comes the next morning. And the girls are sleeping in the car and, like, takes them in. And they're, you know, a little pissed at first. But he explains, like, she doesn't want you guys to get in trouble. So then, yeah, then they, her and the two guys go, and Christian Slater's wanting to steal a car, and she's like, no, we're not stealing a car, we're gonna put an IOU for a car. And they're like, we need wheels. And this is, yeah, it gets, they get split up from each other, and she's like car hopping around, and like everyone's all, fair is fair. And she's just like, keeps running into all these teens that have her haircut now and are like a, you know, a network of getting her back to the abandoned putt-putt golf course.
Yeah.
Because she knows that's where her brother is.
And he's there, and Keith Gordon is there. And we get this romantic scene between her and Keith Gordon, which you said really made the screen sizzle.
It was steaming.
Where they get cozy together in one of the putt-putt
castles or something. I don't know. Yeah.
While their romance isn't necessarily sizzling, I do like them as a couple.
Oh no, I do too. I think it's sweet. It's just such a random coupling.
Yeah.
I was just teasing about that. No, I think it's totally like works for the story, and it's very sweet. I like their little love that's going on.
So yeah, that leads us into the climax. Now, Billie Jean has arranged to have the big meet be at the waterfront. So that's going to mean that we're going to get this huge crowd gathering. The word gets out that this is where this is all going to go down. So all the teenagers have gathered. You got to have your big teenage gathering. Mm-hmm. And the scummy dad has made a real business out of selling Billie Jean merchandise.
There's so much merch. There's that photo you spoke of earlier from coming out, that the guy, creepy guy, took of her coming out of the water. And she's coming out and it's like, where is she now? And then there's like, you know, just all these stills of her from the news or whatever that they're like on bullseyes on posters and said wanted, and frisbees,
t-shirts,
hats, fair is fair. Like, there's so much he's like, he can't even fit it in the store. It's all outside of his store. He has like a like tent set up outside of his store with all of this merch. Oh, and not to mention the most god-awful, ugly, ginormous statue of her.
Yes.
Holding a gun, which I was like, she never held the gun.
This statue, though, is important, though.
It is.
Because, you know, you're watching this and you're wondering, like, the story of Joan of Arc ends with her being burned alive. Is that what's going to happen to Billie Jean? And no, the statue is in effect an effigy that will be symbolically burned at the end of the movie. And that's the thing that gets burned. The image of Billie Jean, mm-hmm. the legend of Billie Jean, so to speak. Of course, this is all going to go horribly wrong. Keith Gordon's dad has bought them a new scooter, and that's sort of being wheeled out in this crowd, and they want to make sure that the scooter is delivered, but then he's also employed all these sharpshooters yep. in the dunes.
Which Peter Coyote is not happy about. He's like, what are you doing?
And this is where things are getting kind of a little silly, because he wouldn't have the authority to hire sharpshooters.
I don't know what, he's the acting attorney general right now. He's running for attorney general or something. I don't know how much power he has, but yeah, the sharpshooters, like Peter Coyote comes over with his badge and he's like, put your guns down. And they're like, here she comes. They can't wait to shoot somebody.
My point is the verisimilitude here is kind of like a little hazy, because it's like teenagers' ideas of what authority figures would behave like. Like, I just don't think any of this would play out this way. You know, I also don't think the guy that would be accused of molesting her would be able to profit off of all of this merchandise.
It's Texas. It's 85. You weren't there. You were off in New England.
There's a lot of highly questionable things going on here.
You don't know what it's like down there.
It's fun, though. And the way the scenario plays out is finally these two figures emerge from the dune. It looks like Keith Gordon and Billie Jean holding a gun on him. But really, Billie Jean is wearing the wig they bought, and she's in the crowd. The crowd doesn't recognize her because she doesn't have her distinctive look. And she goes to where the scooter is up on a truck and, like, pulls off the tarp and makes sure it's there and gives them the thumbs up. And then it's revealed that it's really Christian Slater in drag, dressed like her, because they have similar blonde hair.
Hubie comes running out, and he's like, it's not him, it's her brother. And he's like, shut up, Hubie. Shut up. Yeah. And then he like is waving this fake gun at Hubie, like, but to like to get away, like it's not even a real gun, and then he gets shot.
This whole plan was really bad. What did they think was gonna happen? Binks, you just hold the gun on
None of this makes sense.
Lloyd.
None of this makes sense. I'm right here with you. None of this is
terrible.
None of this tracks.
Whatever Billie Jean may be as a folk hero, she's a terrible planner.
Shitty planner. She's a shitty hostage turnover planner or whatever. I don't know. Yeah.
She should feel bad about getting her brother shot, because she essentially does. But he gets shot. And then Billie Jean goes through the crowd, pulls off the wig, confronts Hubie's dad at his storefront where he's got all the merch.
All the merch. And she hasn't seen this. She hasn't been back to the scene of the crime. I can only imagine what that would feel like, you know, to see like your face. I mean, she's been seeing all these girls doing her hair like hers now. And there's like, you know, people with bumper stickers like I Heart Billie Jean and Fair is Fair. But I don't know how much she's seen as far as like the level of Mr. Pyatt's merch, which is just like, I mean, literally like she's looking at like a whole rack of like Frisbees with her face on it. And just, I mean, it's a lot to take in. And like, you know, he's making money hand over fist, and he still like has been like such a creep. He didn't even pay for the bike. This is where she learns that it was Keith Gordon's dad. It was Dean Stockwell, because she's like, who paid for the bike? And he steps forward. He's like, I did. She's like, oh, for your boy. And it's just like, really, sleazy Mr. Pyatt, you still couldn't. But then, like, now that he's got everybody watching, he like goes over and just has a wad of cash out of the register and just like puts it in her hand. And he's like, just take it, a little more, a little less, just take it. And yeah. And this is when she calls him out on like, oh, I thought we were going to pay as we go, earn as you learn, and all that stuff. And he tries to touch her or something, and somehow he falls down. I don't know if she pushes him or something happens, but he knocks over like a torch that was going or something.
Tiki torch,
of course. And then things start to literally burn and nobody's helping him at all. Like, Hubie just disappears like into the crowd and is just like, later.
The Homer Simpson into the shrubs.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was trying to think of what it was called.
Well, they show Hubie's face and you can tell that even Hubie's disgusted because she's bringing up the sexual advances and she's Me Too-ing his dad. Yeah. And everybody at that point is just like, ew.
Yeah.
You're gross.
So, as you said, this is like the flames are growing. Nobody's helping him put the fire out. Cops just stand in there. No one's doing anything, and everyone starts throwing their merch into the fire and taking off their hats and their shirts and all that stuff.
Yes, to the strains of Invincible by Pat Benatar. It's actually kind of moving.
It is empowering. It feels good.
And the big statue of her is on top of his store or whatever, and it lights on fire.
And she's just watching herself burn. And this, too, again, with what you're talking about, rolling back the stakes, like, Peter Coyote's just like, there you go, kid. She's not arrested.
Nope.
She just, like, kind of, like, nods or smiles at her, pats her on the back. There's some sort of, like, thing like that, but just keeps it moving.
It's kind of like frontier justice, you know? It's like, well, your brother got shot, so it's okay now.
Fair is fair. Fair is fair. A shoulder for a shoulder.
Yeah, he got shot in the same shoulder as the dad did.
Which, trust me, I noted that. I was like, oh, notice how these cops can hit right in the shoulder with a gun. That's not always the way.
Well, he's a white boy. Mm. So, yeah, you know, we already talked about the really bad tagged on ending. But, this is the way the movie ends.
This is the legend of Billie Jean.
So let me ask you this. Why do you think this legend failed?
Well, it's interesting. I was thinking about that as we were talking. And I was thinking, like, it was so made for the kids. Why didn't the kids show up? And I can only say, like, I mean, because Helen Slater had Supergirl previously, but there's no one else in this film. I mean, this is one of Christian Slater's first films. He's only 15. He was like having to go to school on set and everything. But there's no other names at all. I'm just thinking that Helen Slater didn't have enough of a draw. But it was for the MTV crowd. So I don't know. I was too young. Why didn't you show up, Sebby?
Well, I think that they just didn't really do a good job of selling it to the people they needed to sell it to. I mean, they did through MTV, but I mean, I think it also was hard to sell a female empowerment story
at this time.
You know, a few years later, you'd get The Lost Boys. And I know that's not really the same thing, but I responded to that. And that there's a very strong streak of teenage rebellion in that movie, but it's kind of male centric.
Yeah.
There just weren't really movies that had female protagonists that were appealing to teenage boys at this time. It was still pretty segregated in that way. Mm-hmm. It was like boys had their interests and girls had theirs. I mean, like a movie like Foxes, I think that was years earlier, but you know, I think that spoke more to the female experience than this did.
Absolutely.
You know, like this almost is like a male empowerment kind of story. I think in the 90s or the 2000s or whatever, you could have sold this better. I think, you know, especially Riot Girl era, like you could have sold something like this if you made it a little harder edged, you know. I just think it wasn't the right time for like a female led teenage rebellion movie. I also think calling it The Legend of Billie Jean was weird because of the Michael Jackson song, right? Billie Jean. Like, people were like, is this about that Michael Jackson song?
It was too close. They considered calling it Fair is Fair, but then they changed it.
I don't think that would have done any better. I just think it was a hard sell at that time, selling a movie on a female lead.
Who's not even that well known.
Right, who's not that well known. You don't have any other big stars in there.
None. But I think it like has become beloved through cable, like a lot of things have. Like, I think a lot of people have love for this film after the fact. They just didn't go to the theater.
I also think with teenage rebellion stories, you're walking a fine line, because if you get it right, teenagers are going to really respond to it. But if you don't quite get it right, they're going to reject it. You know what I mean? Like, they've got a really high threshold for what they're going to buy as cool. And I just remember as a teenager at the time, I didn't look at this and think, oh, that looks cool. Mm-hmm. I was like, that looks dumb. And if that's what you're thinking as a teenager, you're going to turn on it.
Oh, I completely understand that. I have that feeling about a lot of things still in my 40s.
You can apply this to anything. It's like whenever they're really trying to get to you specifically, if you're the demographic and they're like, this is for you, and if you don't feel it, you're going to be like, fuck you.
No, it's still, that's what I'm saying to this day. Like, there's things where I'm like, oh, I feel seen. That is speaking to me. But then there's other things where even as a middle-aged woman, I still feel like it's like, hello, fellow teenagers.
Right. You know? Well, like a more modern example, I would say, like, I remember, like, I was 40 when This Is 40 came out. And I was like, no way am I seeing that movie.
Yeah.
And look, I think this movie is a fun movie. Like, I would recommend it. It's a fun watch. But I don't think it gets the teenage experience really right.
Well, I mean, you don't even really get that in this. I mean, it's such a specific experience for like a specific class of people in a specific area. You know what I mean? Like, it's more like you said earlier, it's about that they, you know, are lower income, so nobody cares.
Well, you know, it's a perfect example of something that really connected with teenagers at this exact time was Breakfast Club, which isn't really like the same kind of thing. It's not like full on teenage rebellion, but that spoke to the teenage experience in a much broader way because it had all different classes of teenagers.
Yes, all stuck together.
All different, like cliques.
Yes.
And that was something that everybody could relate to.
You could find somebody you could relate to.
Yes.
Yeah. Or you knew people like that in your school.
Yeah.
It's a different thing. But like, unless you're maybe from this area or something, like, it's very specific.
Yeah. It's narrow in its like field of vision. And I think that's not how you sell something to teenagers, especially not in the 80s. Because that was the time when we were all really becoming conscious for the first time of like cliques and stuff. Not for the first time. I know it had been going on before that, but it really, movies like The Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink and all those kind of John Hughes movies were really diving into that thing of like, oh, you belong to this group. You can't hang out with that group or whatever. So I just think, this movie wasn't speaking to that, and that wasn't what the average 80s teenager felt.
Fair is fair.
Fair is fair. It's a do or die situation.
We will be invincible.
We will be invincible. All right. Well, I'm going to go get on my scooter and collect my $608 and give myself a stylish 80s haircut. That about does it today for Tentpole Trauma. If you like what you heard, check out our social media presence on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for Tentpole Trauma. That was easy, wasn't it? If you like us, hit subscribe and leave us a sterling review on iTunes, if you dare. If you really like us, head over to patreon.com and get involved in one of our fabulous tiers. You'll be glad you did. Want to communicate with Tentpole Trauma? Send an email to tentpoletrauma@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And who knows, one day you may even get your email read on one of our shows. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you real soon.